Welcome to the Bridging Connections podcast. This podcast will introduce you to the people who are on the cutting edge of Jewish innovation. You will be hearing from founders and directors of contemporary organizations creating new paths to participate in Jewish life. In this podcast, you will learn about best practices, tips for engagement, and how to create meaningful connections. This is a place that will bridge you to the tools and resources used by the Jewish leaders, visionaries, and innovators that are creating a new sustainable Judaism. I'm your host, Elizabeth Dosage, and I welcome you to come bridge the gap with me. Hello, Bridges 613 and the Bridging Connection podcast listeners. I'm so excited to share with you that I am in conversation today with Rabbi Mina Bronberg. She is the creator of Fat Torah, and I'm not going to say much more because I'm going to let our conversation dive in, talk more about what that is and what it's doing and how you can learn more and be involved. So since you are in Jerusalem, I'm going to say good evening, although it is morning for me, but hello and good day to everyone, wherever we're all listening in from. So glad to have you here today.
It's great to be here. Thank you so much for the opportunity to be in conversation with you.
We like to start these conversations by getting an understanding of your background to understand what was the impetus for you to create Fat Torah.
Well, I am a fat woman, and I think it's always good for me to explain right off the bat why I use that language to describe myself, because it could be quite jarring for people. So I'll start there. I use the word fat to describe myself because I believe that it's a morally neutral way of describing a particular kind of human body in the wonderful diversity of human bodies that exist. And certainly also, I feel that it's just a really nice, accurate descriptor of my body. I think a lot of other terms that folks use to describe fat bodies are usually sort of rooted in shame or embarrassment around the bodies that we have, and that's not what I'm about. So I am a fat woman, and I've been involved in the world of fat activism for the last 30 years or so. And I was ordained 10 years ago and realized that wasn't really sort of bringing my fat activism into my rabbinate in a very thorough way. I would say didn't feel especially called to do that until I realized that really my voice as a fat activist was really missing from my rabbinate, and that there were ways that weight stigma and anti-fat bias were impacting people's Jewish lives in really harmful ways, and that I had something to say about that. And I think also that I had always felt really sort of supported in my body liberation work by my Jewish background. So I started dieting as a 7-year-old and gave it up as a 16-year-old. And really from pretty early on in my own journey, I felt like the decision to stop dieting and sort of see what freedom from dieting might be like really resonated for me, even as quite a young person, with Yetziat Mitzrayim, with the Exodus from Egypt, right? Which, with this sense of what it means to really experience for ourselves, as we're taught that we're meant to do, to experience for ourselves that move from stuckness to freedom. And then later on, much later on, when I've learned that there's a tradition of translating the word Mitzrayim, which is the word for Egypt, as translating that word creatively as the narrow place, that sort of added all these other layers of what it meant to really experience my own liberation as being letting go of this and moving out of this place of narrowness, narrow body ideals. And I would say that's kind of how my own Jewish background feels connected for me with this work.
So obviously our listeners can't see our conversation, but when you spoke about the translation of Mitzrayim as narrowness, it came to my mind the second before you started. And so it just put a big smile on my face because I right away made that correlation before you said it. And I think it's profound, that idea of trying to dispel the, first of all, the narrowness of fat shaming, and also coming out of the idea that we must be narrow.
Yep, exactly.
Right. So that's really interesting and made me smile because I felt like, oh, wow, I'm thinking on the same page. Mm-hmm. Back up, there are two things that stood out. I'm going to start with the first thing. You spoke of the word fat as a morally neutral word, and you somewhat describe what that means, but I wish you
go into that more about what that means to be a morally neutral.
Oh, thanks. That's a great question. So I think typically when we use the word fat in our culture, we're using it as a way of marking a certain kind of body that are denigrated and devalued and made fun of. So it's not typically used as a morally neutral word, right? It's typically used as a way to harm people. And so to reclaim it as simply best and most accurate way of describing my body is a way of making it morally neutral in the sense of saying that it's neither good nor bad to be fat. It's simply a way of describing a particular kind of body. And as I said, you know, I think some of this is also about, this gets more into the theology of the thing, but, you know, we have a lot of ways of thinking in Judaism about how God's greatness is expressed in the diversity of creation. And so, you know, we have from Psalms this beautiful line of Marabu Maaseich Adonai, how manifold, it's sometimes translated, how manifold are your works, right? How diverse is creation. And that's really seen as a way of praising God. And yet somehow in terms of people's body size, we really feel like we need to just narrow that diversity. And so it's also just a way of sort of marking that fat bodies are just one aspect of bodily diversity and that that diversity is a beautiful thing.
And leading right into this, you talked about something that, to be right here on the same page with you, I'm also a fat woman. Mm-hmm. And you spoke about fat activism. Mm-hmm. So I have been a fat woman most of my life, and this is not something I've ever heard of and I'm not familiar with. And I'd love for you to talk a little bit more about what that is.
Sure. So I'm actually, by the time people hear this, the course will be over, but I've been enjoying teaching a course on what we can learn from the last 50 years of the fat liberation movement. And the reason that we're picking the 50 years is because next year we're going to be celebrating the 50th anniversary of the publication of a document called the Fat Liberation Manifesto, which was put out in 1973 by a group called the Fat Underground, which was a group of primarily women in Los Angeles who were, you know, gathered together to really speak out about the ill treatment that they received in medical and in healthcare and employment and in education just because of their body size. It happens to have been written by two women who were Jewish. And so that's why I say 50 years, but the sort of organized fat activism in the US actually dates a few years farther back to 1969 when there was an organization that was started that's still going strong today. In fact, I would say stronger than ever in a lot of ways. And that organization is called the National Association to Advance Fat Acceptance, NAFA. So that was started in 1969 by a small group of folks. And at some point, it's no longer structured this way, but NAFA had chapters all over the US of folks who would gather locally. And I think one thing to think about in terms of activism is that, you know, I think a lot of the ways that various identities and bodies are marginalized, you know, have folks in those identities and in those bodies who have spoken up in various ways to really try to change both the culture and also to change the laws so that they could receive equal treatment. So on the one hand, the fat liberation movement has been around for over 50 years in an organized way in the US. On the other hand, it's still the case that it's not illegal to discriminate against people based on height and weight in most of the 50 states. So there are two states and a few municipalities where fat activists have worked to get legislation passed to make it illegal to discriminate against people because of their body size. But that's not true in most of the United States. So on the one hand, there's, you know, the movement's been around for 50 years. On the other hand, certainly in terms of, I would say, both cultural and structural change, we've got ways to go.
Definitely. I mean, just by the fact that I'm not even familiar with this allergy, and I fall in the category, mm-hmm. It's surprising. And I'm sure that many people are thinking the same.
Yeah. I think some of that is because it's very, you know, one thing that you need in order to organize a successful movement is people who are willing to refuse to be shamed. And that is very, very difficult for people in larger bodies when, you know, the entire medical world and, you know, so many other areas of our lives are built around, you know, blaming us for our size, not giving us equal access or equal treatment. And so, you know, when you have an identity that people are, you know, not to mention the fact that there's a, you know, a over $70 billion diet industry just in the US. So it's not too surprising that, you know, you need people to claim an identity in order to build a movement around an identity. And when you have an identity that's so disparaged that everyone, not everyone, thank God, but so many people are spending billions of dollars to try to get out of that identity, it's not surprising that the movement would have a hard time making headway.
Without a doubt. So, okay, so I feel like you explained very well about the impetus and, you know, why you wanted to start this and your background. So tell me kind of what the mission is for Fat Torah. Yeah, let's start there.
Yeah. So our mission and our focus is really spreading Jewish body justice. So I can unpack that a little bit. So that means confronting weight stigma where it shows up as a barrier to full participation in Jewish communal life. And it also means using Jewish tradition itself in ways that are fat liberatory. So looking at how our values of seeing every human being as created in the divine image and things like envisioning Yitzhak Mitzrayim as a coming out of narrowness. And I know that we're hoping that people will be hearing this during Hanukkah. So certainly from my perspective, Hanukkah is really a celebration of fat. I mean, that is actually the miracle that we're celebrating there, is fat as a symbol of our people's endurance in the face of hardship. And that's why we eat. That's exactly why we eat fried foods and light Hanukkah lights and all of that. And so really having this sense of how tradition can be used in ways that are liberatory is the other piece of it. So both confronting stigma and bias where it shows up, and also really celebrating the ways that Jewish tradition can be liberatory for all bodies.
Since you brought up Hanukkah, it made me think of, I'm keen on listening to language, and especially language and how it's translated from Hebrew to English. And The word fat may connotate, of course, a larger body, right? But the word fat also is food that we cook with. We cook with fat, right? Mm-hmm. And in Hanukkah, the tradition is to cook in oil. And what I think is interesting is the word in Hebrew for oil is shemen, right? It's fat. Yeah. It's actually fat. It almost seems like in English we whitewash it by having a different word saying oil, which takes off the element of fat. But it's the same word. And when you actually say I'm fat in Hebrew, you're using the same root. Right.
Right. It's interesting.
Really interesting.
Yeah. So definitely the same root. I will say that just to be a little language geeky for a moment, I think that in some ways it's easier in English because we do have fat, just the word fat without it having to be like in a different form as a way to talk about the substance that we eat. And also the bodies that we have, and also the tissue in our bodies that is fat tissue. And so in some ways, the word fat in English is much more flexible than the Hebrew words, even though the Hebrew words share that same root. I've definitely spoken with, you know, fat activists here about, you know, what words should we be using to sort of make those connections.
Yeah, it's interesting. I just like the play of language and how it comes
out. Absolutely.
And how it is either rigid or more fluid, right? So tell me, what are you doing with Fat Torah how are you engaging people? How are you helping people overcome these stigmas and biases?
So I think I love to think about sort of the internal work and the external work. So by external work, I mean, you know, really spreading the word about Fat Torah to folks who really might not be familiar with the concept of anti-fat bias or have thought about how it affects their Jewish communities. And then also really helping to strengthen and support folks who are already, at least in some way, involved in fat activism within the Jewish world. So in terms of practically what that means, a big part of our work really is awareness raising through media coverage and podcasts. And I also do quite a bit of writing. And when I first started Fat Torah, I thought it was just a book that I was writing. And that was going to be, you know, the way to spread the word. And that's still a book that's in the works. But what became clear to me was also how important community building was. And so we have a wonderful online community of about 890 members at this point. And it's folks who, you know, turn to each other for support with particularly difficult encounters that they've had, or advice around, you know, how to talk to either into a family member or in a professional setting. There's also a fair number of rabbis and cantors and Jewish lay leaders who are really thinking together about how to bring this into their own communities, and the online community is a source of support and encouragement and education also about sort of how best to talk about all of this. And then another piece that I really love is that I do quite a bit of teaching, both in the form of workshops that I bring to synagogues and hillels and other Jewish communal settings, and then also longer courses where we can really sort of dig into what I think about as a Fat Torah approach to text study and to looking at the Jewish text and Jewish tradition. So those are some of our activities. And then I also offer, you know, one-on-one mentoring for folks, either Jewish educators or folks who are in contexts where they really want some more specific support around how to bring a message of Jewish body justice into the work that they do in the world.
Okay. So you mentioned this online community.
Yeah.
So I'd like our listeners to know how they would access that.
Yeah. So right now it's a Facebook group. And if you search on Facebook under Fat Torah, you'll see both our page for the organization and also the Fat Torah Facebook group. And folks are certainly welcome to join.
I'll definitely put links to that in the show notes.
Yeah. So that, and then also if you're just, not just, but if you're interested in more kind of the public content that we share, then we are on Facebook and Instagram. And then we also, you know, have a mailing list where we share information about our various goings on, and that folks can join just by going to our website, which is just fattorah.org.
Okay, so I might be putting you on the spot, and if I am, you could tell me no. But I'm wondering if you can give us at least just one small resource that you find in the Torah that helps with this work.
Absolutely. So we know from the very beginning of the Bereshit, of the book of Genesis, this idea that human beings are created in the divine image. But what the implications of that are then gets sort of played out in different places in Jewish text. And one of my favorites is in Mishnah Sanhedrin, so an early rabbinic text. And the topic of this part of the Mishnah is actually what to do, basically how to run a case where someone is being tried for murder. And because the Jewish tradition, on the one hand, we have sort of this biblical idea about capital punishment. And on the other hand, we have this rabbinic concern about capital punishment being applied too easily. And so there's a whole section in Mishnah Sanhedrin that's about how you warn the witnesses in capital cases. In other words, right, you're about to testify against someone who you believe has committed murder. And the rabbis of the Mishnah want you as the witness to know that you're really holding this person's life in your hands. So because that's the framework that they're working from, it really lets them talk about human worth and what it means to hold someone else's life in your hands. And one thing that I love about this is that, you know, we're not talking about someone who's, you know, a wonderful scholar or teacher or lifesaver or anything. We're talking about someone who is suspected of having committed a murder. And that's who it is that we're talking about holding as a precious human life that's created in the divine image. And this is actually the place where we get a very famous rabbinic teaching that talks about about what it means to be created in the divine image, and says that when a human king wants to make coins with the king's image on them, he stamps out the coins and all the coins look the same. But God's greatness is reflected in the fact that God creates us in the image of the very first human being, and all of us look different. And so what I take from this is this real celebration of God's greatness in the diversity of human bodies. I think we maybe sometimes tend to think of being created in the divine image as something that's about our soul and not our body, but the Mishnah is really not making, certainly the Torah is not making that distinction at all, right? So this idea that every single human being is created in the divine image, and the Mishnah follows that by saying that because we know this about ourselves, that we're all created in the image of that first human and in the image of who was created in the image of the divine, that we're actually obligated to say that the world was created for my sake. And I was teaching, I was actually having a sort of community, like a Fat Torah community gathering, a little over a year ago now. And one of the participants in the gathering was talking about the difficulties of fat phobia and the ways that we're made to feel like we don't belong. And she said, all of a sudden, she said, you know, it's just, this world just wasn't made for us. And this Mishnah immediately came to mind, right? Because it's not the case. It is the case that society is structured in ways that exclude us. And at the same time, we have this much deeper theological teaching that says, no, actually, it's on all of us to believe that the world was created for us individually. And that if you're in a place where you're excluded, that you can carry that knowledge with you, that this isn't, that the world was not made for you, the world was made for you, and that it's human choices that have led to some people being marginalized and excluded. And so that means that we can hopefully make human changes that allow for a world where everyone belongs.
Thank you for that, Debar Torah. I appreciate your teaching. And it just, for me, instills in the fact that there is everything in our Torah, mm-hmm. and it is not passé or outdated, that the more we study it, the more we find how relevant it is to our lives in every aspect. So mm-hmm. I really appreciate that, because I know we can always find something that speaks to whatever we're looking for. So that's great. Thank you so much.
Yeah,
so is there anything else that you want to share with us that we haven't covered about Fat Torah? Anything you think we missed?
Well, one thing that I'll say that does feel especially important for Hanukkah is that, you know, one thing that happens in a world that's so suffused with diet culture is that a lot of our traditional foods really get denigrated. And this isn't just an issue. This is certainly an issue for Jewish food, but it's also an issue for a lot of other, what we might think of as ethnic foods or foods of other marginalized groups as well, that that we think of, you know, the food that we think of traditional foods as somehow less than or not good for us or not clean. And that is really, from my perspective, that is really Christian supremacy at work. And I would say also white supremacy at work. And that one way that we can really move away from anti-fat bias and toward a world where everybody belongs is to simply enjoy the foods of our tradition, and to also have the foods of our tradition be morally neutral, and to really allow ourselves to enjoy. So I think especially at Hanukkah, when you know, there's so much just damaging talk around latkes and sufganiyot and all of those yummy Hanukkah foods, that we can really, like, I just really would love to invite people to see what it's like to refrain from making denigrating comments about fried foods and see what it's like to enjoy them without that disparagement going on.
And the bottom line is, I think those that set up our traditions and the founders of the traditions surrounding Hanukkah wanted us to enjoy and mm-hmm. find pleasure in it, because we're enjoying the story and we're reliving a freedom. Mm-hmm. So of course we shouldn't be denigrating what we eat. It's mm-hmm. It makes sense to me.
Yeah.
All right. So I've looked at your website and I want to ask about this. You mm-hmm. mentioned in some writings about this concept of health at any size.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm familiar with this concept too.
Mm-hmm.
But let's talk about the balance between accepting our bodies as we are mm-hmm. and also working on making choices that keep us healthy, because we do know that food has an ability to cause illness sometimes. And maybe you're going to tell me I'm wrong. And that's okay. And Phil, food also can help with health as well. And so I really would like you to comment a little bit about that.
So certainly for folks who are interested in a weight neutral approach to health, the world of health at every size is a good resource to look into. I would say that in some ways, the bottom line for me, for Fat Torah, is that people are worthy of belonging, regardless of whether they're healthy or not.
Oh, that's poignant. I just want to let that sit in. And maybe you should say that again.
Absolutely. So I think that I'll say it a different way, that I think for a lot of my life and for a lot of my life in fat activism, I did a lot of work around, you know, trying to prove to people how healthy I was. Right. So, you know, someone would ask about my health and I would say, well, look at my blood pressure and look at my blood sugar and aren't I healthy? And it's really only in the last several years that I've realized how, I would say, really ableist that is. Right. That it implies that I'm only worthy of being who I am if I can prove to, and my life is only worth living in some ways if I can prove to you that I'm healthy. And I really reject that at this point, that it's really important to me that we understand that our human worth is not actually measured by our health. And that there are many, many things that go into health and many, many things that go into illness. And many of them are private and not things that we should be asked to sort of trot out in order to prove our worth. So that feels like the bottom line for me. If you look into the world of health at every size, there's wonderful, you know, research and things to learn about the difference between the fact that fat people are at higher risk for certain diseases versus saying that fatness causes certain diseases. There are no diseases that fat people have that thin people don't have. And the way that anti-fat bias plays out in, certainly in healthcare, is bad for people of every size. So, for example, I've spoken to people in thin bodies whose sleep apnea went undiagnosed for years, despite the fact that they were complaining to their doctors about like classic sleep apnea symptoms. Because their doctor couldn't imagine that a thin person could suffer from something that their doctor was thinking of as a quote unquote, you know, fat disease. So there's certainly important research on the, you know, just on the difference between, this is the social scientist in me coming out, but the difference between correlation and causality, that because two things are correlated does not mean that one causes the other. And, you know, again, when we think about groups that are at higher risk, what I would want healthcare and health, you know, thinking about health to look like for fat people would be to say, you know, if you're at higher risk of something, then let's look at what kinds of things you can do, regardless of what size you are, to lower that risk. And let's look at what pieces are out of your control. Let's look at both of those. And let's also, when we're sort of computing risk, let's also take into account the role that stigma plays in people's physical health and mental health and spiritual health. Because one thing that we also know from the research is that fat people are disinclined to seek medical treatment, because when they seek medical treatment, they receive bad treatment. So, you know, I think of myself as someone who's, you know, sort of well-versed in all of this and a good advocate for myself. I personally went to the doctor. You know, I told you that I started off saying that health is no one's business, and now I'm going to tell you about a doctor visit. So I went to the doctor, I guess maybe a year and a half ago or so, and I had some test results that I don't remember exactly what they were, but it was test results where it was two measures that usually sort of move up or down together. And my test results showed that I had, you know, like a high level of one thing, but a low level of something else in my blood. These are blood tests. And so I asked my doctor, just trying to understand what was happening with my body, you know, what does it mean that, you know, X is high, but Y is normal? And my doctor, without asking anything about my life or how I was living it, said, well, what it says is that you have good genetics and bad behavior.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
You're telling the story, but I'm having flashbacks of very similar stories in doctors'
offices. Absolutely. Absolutely.
To the point where, and you talk about, you know, people not going to healthcare and things like that. So one of the things that I've stopped doing is getting weighed every time I go to the doctor, because I realize that my weight doesn't necessarily have a direct effect on what is going on in my body. And
right. If you're,
different things right. We can do to advocate for ourselves.
Right. If you're my anesthesiologist and I'm about to be put under for surgery, I absolutely want you to accurately know how to dose my anesthesia.
Of course. Yes.
Right. If you're thinking, you know, if you're a doctor of mine who's planning to, you know, give me medicine based that's, you know, that whose dose is based on weight, then of course I want you to know what my weight is. But if you're just going to use it to tell me that I'm living wrong when you haven't even bothered to ask me what I eat or how I move my body, then I'm not going to actually accept that as an accurate measure of my health, especially at a time when we have things like blood pressure cuffs and easy ways of measuring people's blood sugar and all kinds of other health measures. And also, you know, just to come back to, I started off by saying, you know, when there are, you know, there are other groups that are at high risk for all kinds of things, but because they're not marginalized or stigmatized groups, we don't sort of blame them for what's happening for them, right? So like, I'm going to guess that skiers, people who ski a lot, are at much higher risk than the rest of us of particular injuries.
Right.
They are a population that's at increased risk. But I'm going to guess that they don't, across the board, get told that they need to stop skiing because it's bad for their health. Because we don't stigmatize skiers. Maybe some people stigmatize skiers. I don't know. But
society as a whole does not.
Exactly. And so it's just a much, I think it's important, you know, when we think about people's health, to realize that that physical health and mental health and spiritual health are all important. And I also think, you know, as I said in the beginning, that this idea that we would somehow value someone's life based on their health status is abhorrent. And I feel like, you know, that for me is really the bottom line, that without even going into any of the research on the impacts of weight stigma on health or any of that, or the impacts of racism on health, and we know that, you know, anti-fat bias, certainly in a U.S. context, is really connected with anti-Black racism. So, you know, even without going into any of the statistics, I really think it's important that we, you know, stop valuing people based on our perceptions of their health or illness.
So as a person that may be struggling with this fat bias, and generally it starts with your inner circle, the people closest to you, friends and family that are closest to you, what advice do you give a person that wants to start raising awareness with their inner circle, with their people closest to them, where wants to start being able to advocate for themselves when someone says, oh, it looks like you've gained a few pounds, or you've lost a few pounds, or even said, yeah, you know, I gained like 10 pounds and I can't get it off. And, you know, that are constantly bringing up these fat biases in their lives all the time. So what advice do you give to a person to start this work and being an advocate?
So I think that advocating for ourselves can be a wonderful thing. I also think that I don't want anyone to feel pressured to solve a problem that's not theirs, right? The anti-fat bias that's being directed at them is not their problem. It's the person who's speaking to them in that way that has the problem. So one way of dealing with that is certainly to advocate for ourselves. Another way of doing it is not necessarily any easier, but maybe more straightforward, is to set boundaries about, you know, what kind of talk we will and will not put up with in particular relationships. You said, you know, how do we deal with this with our inner circle? And my immediate thought was, why in the world would you start with your inner circle?
Right. Because it's probably the hardest one to crack.
Right. Those most intimate relationships can be some of the hardest to deal with. And so I think in some ways, the question is really, you know, how can I both think about in a broader way that sort of takes it off my own body, my belief that all human beings should have equality in healthcare and education and employment and public accommodation, right? That's one way of sort of taking the focus off of my own body. I think that, you know, there's been a lot of emphasis on body positivity in the last decade and a half or so. And I think body positivity can be a wonderful thing to experience. You know, it's wonderful to have a loving relationship with your own body. I feel extremely blessed for the times when I'm able to have a loving relationship with my body. And I think it's too often used to sort of put undue pressure on ourselves, right? To make it seem as if the problem here is whether you love yourself or not, right? The problem is not whether I love myself or not. The problem is that bodies like mine are stigmatized and degraded and laughed at publicly and openly. And so to sort of take the onus off of ourselves to be doing all of the work of shifting that, I think, can be really important. And I think also finding community, right? Finding other people with whom you can exist in ways where you're not pressured to lose weight if that's not of interest to you, and where you are accepted for who you are. So absolutely finding community. And also one thing that's been really helpful, I think, to a lot of people, especially in a social media context, is, you know, following people on social media who look like you and have relationships with their bodies that you aspire to. So, you know, we talk sometimes about the idea of representation. And on the one hand, you know, we don't see fat bodies being treated in any kind of neutral way in most of the media that's available. On the other hand, in social media, we're able to curate what we see and don't see. And we're able to make some choices, not entirely, because, of course, you know, the algorithm does its thing and the advertising does its thing. Right. But we're still able to make choices about who we see, and we can surround ourselves with, you know, wonderful fat people living wonderful lives and really have that also be a positive influence on our own relationships with ourselves.
You've given us so much to think about. And in my mind, one of the things I started to say was, oh, well, thank you for all the food for thought. This isn't necessarily about food. And so I was like, no, I don't think that's the right term. This is about, you know, what you started to bring up is that getting people to accept ourselves as divine creatures, right? Mm-hmm. So I feel like I've learned so much just getting myself to think about the words that I'm using mm-hmm. on it. So all of my podcasts kind of end in two very important questions for the work that we're doing at Bridges 613. Mm-hmm. And one of our biggest things that we're proud to do is showcase organizations that have come up that are innovating and reinventing Jewish space, and thus, of course, we're Jews that live in the world, so beyond Jewish space and throughout the world. So I'd like to ask you other organizations that you're familiar with that you're excited about that are innovating Jewish space.
So I would say that, you know, I take a good deal of strength and comfort from other organizations that are exploring Jewish tradition through and around marginalized identities. So there's, you know, certainly Svara that's been around for a while that's taking a queer look at Torah, and the Jews of Color Torah Academy. I'm forgetting its exact name right now. And there's, is it Amud?
Amud.
Yep. Yeah. And there's also some wonderful efforts starting around Torah and disability justice. Jess Velasco has been involved in doing some of that work. So those are some of the folks who I feel are, from my perspective anyway, are sort of our kindreds in looking at how to have Torah be a source of liberation for marginalized bodies.
I love that. And isn't that what Torah meant to be in, as the onset, is a source of liberation for whatever we need liberation from? So mm-hmm. I think that ties it all together so perfectly. Mm-hmm. I feel like I say this every time, but it's poignant to me. The biggest Jewish thing I do every day is wake up and say my Moda Ani, and I have a strong gratitude practice. Mm-hmm. We know that Judaism has a strong gratitude practice. So yeah. To end today by asking, what are you grateful for?
I'm grateful for the strength of Jewish tradition, I would say. So the phrase that comes to mind from Psalms is Lulei Toratcha Shashuai Azavadati Boni, that were not your Torah my delight, I would have perished in my affliction. And so certainly the way that Torah and being able to delight in and play with Torah as a real source of strength and liberation is a huge, something I'm hugely grateful for.
I'm grateful for all the Torah I learned during this conversation with you. When I started this podcast, I never would have thought that so many of the conversations would be Torah study. And I really celebrate that. So thank you for yet again being a guest that has taught me so much. I hope all the listeners feel the same. I really appreciate that.
Yeah. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for tuning in to the Bridging Connections podcast. This podcast and Bridges 613 will succeed if its social media reach is wide. Please partner with us to promote this important work. You can follow us on Facebook at Bridges 613 and visit our website at www.bridges613.org. There you can read blogs, listen to past podcasts, and subscribe to our newsletter. Please share the podcast and our social media links with your community and enable others to benefit and learn about the groundbreaking innovation taking place in our beloved Jewish community. Your support is greatly appreciated.